الكلمات in the سطوح. For an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahth al-Kharij. Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and let me ask you this question. If, you know, you're wearing a coat or a drop of blood falls on it, okay?
Yeah.
And the blood spreads into the lining of the coat.
Yes.
Well, is it considered one space or two spaces stained with blood? If it is considered one space, then it is not bigger than one dirham, okay?
Yeah.
And if it is considered two spaces, then it is bigger than the size of a dirham. How should one go about it and offer the prayer?
Yeah, that's a very good question because, you know, most of the coats or clothes we wear have, you know, a lining.
Yes.
And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the blood reaches the lining, then that is a separate thing, and the blood on the lining should be considered separately, and therefore if those two drops, if those two parts, stained parts, are considered as one or put together, and if the total amount, the space is covered by the two, by the coat and the lining, is lesser than the size of a dirham, then you can pray with it. Otherwise, if both of them make cover a bigger part or a bigger space, or a space bigger than the size of a dirham, then of course you cannot pray with that blood, and you have to wash it.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, one of the conditions in you said that must be or should be fulfilled when praying or saying the prayer was that the material or the fabric of the clothes that you're wearing should come from halal sources, all right?
Yeah.
And it should not be usurped, for example.
Yeah.
Because it's haram, in fact, to wear that. And so obviously you said that the kind of prayer that is offered in that usurped type of dress will be invalid, right?
Yeah.
But what if the person doesn't know that, you know, such a dress or usurped dress is haram, and it renders the prayer invalid.
A person who does not know is not under any obligation. He can continue doing his responsibility and his duty of praying, and his prayer is valid because he's not to blame. Ignorance is a bliss sometimes, you know, when you are not aware. I mean, you do not know. You are not held responsible for not knowing, and when you know, you have to take action. Otherwise, your prayer is considered to be valid.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same case, in the example that you gave, a person does not know that his clothes is usurped, for example,
yes.
And he prays with it, and later on he understands or he comes to know that the cloth he was wearing was kind of, you know, usurped. In that case, his prayer is valid, of course, and there's no problem in the prayer that he offers.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Well, what about a part of this dress comes from that usurped, for example, source, such as a button or two?
Yeah, that's also a good question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the buttons or maybe the thread. You know,
yes,
the thread. Used in the cloth.
Yes.
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that if the thread or the buttons are usurped, again the prayer is going to be invalid.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot wear a shirt whose buttons are usurped or whose thread has been illicitly obtained from some sources, from somewhere. And, of course, the prayer will be affected according to his eminence.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, let's take a short break, Sheikh Javid, and we'll be back with more questions. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear beloved guest speaker here in the studio with us, talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, one of the conditions you mentioned earlier about the clothes, all right?
Yeah.
Or one of the conditions that must be fulfilled about the clothes of a person performing prayers should not be, in fact, made up of a part of the animal, which are specific, all right?
Yes.
So what animals do you mean, or do the religious authorities, in fact, refer to when they say, for example, the parts of those clothes should not come from those animals, first of all right?
Yeah.
And how do we know which parts of those animals are najis or which part are not?
Well, the animals, whether they are halal or haram,
mm-hmm.
If they are not slaughtered according to Islamic law, then they are going to be najis. And you cannot pray with any parts of those animals. With the skin or with the bones or any part of the animal, the carcass or the dead body of an animal that has not been slaughtered according to Islamic law. And when it comes to haram animal, of course you cannot pray with any parts, even including the hair and the nails or any other parts of the animal. All of that animal is najis, and you cannot wear cloth or a garment with the hair of those animals or that animal on your cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And but when it comes to halal animal like a sheep or a goat or a cow, okay, if it's not slaughtered according to Islamic law, its hair is pure. You can pray with that hair, but you cannot pray with the skin or the hide of that animal because it was not made pure. It was not slaughtered according to Islamic law.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. What is Ayatollah Khamenei's position in regards to the parts of the animal which does not have a gushing blood? Is it permissible, Sheikh Javi, to wear a dress with the hide of such animals?
Well, animals, that's a very good question, because we need to differentiate between animals that have gushing blood and animals that do not have gushing blood, you know. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the animals that have gushing blood, of course, we have already explained the rules regarding gushing animals, such animals. These animals, the blood of these animals and the urine and every part of these animals, if they are not slaughtered according to Islamic law, or are impure. But when it comes to animals that do not have gushing blood, like for example a fish, okay, if a dead fish is found on the seashore,
mm-hmm.
and you touch it, it's not najis. It's you know, it doesn't have gushing blood.
Mm-hmm.
And if, for example, a part of that fish is found in your clothes or on your dress, and you pray with it, it's not going to affect your prayer. Now, the fish is just an example. You can generalize it. You can give the example of insects. You can give the examples of some species that do not have gushing blood. If a part of these species that do not have gushing blood is found on your clothes, or your clothes is made with a part of these animals,
mm-hmm.
then your prayer is valid, and you don't have to, you know, change your clothes. You don't have to wash it, or you don't have to remove it.
Right.
Yes. Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that the precaution is to remove that part or that piece, mm-hmm. from the animal that does not have the gushing blood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better not to wear your prayers with that part of a dead animal that does not have gushing blood.
Blood, I see.
It's more precautionary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Iraqis are still skeptical that the U.S. withdrawal from their country will be a real one. Who's to blame them when the first announced official date of the long goodbye was supposedly August 2021, as per the Trump administration? However, the deadline was simply ignored by the new Biden administration. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi met in Washington and allegedly agreed to conclude the American combat mission in Iraq by December 31st, 2021. That's 3 days from now. Really? They are just going to simply leave? Well, follow me a little. Let us see how the U.S. operates in Iraq to begin with. It is no secret that the U.S. had adopted a low-cost colonial system of ruling Iraq for almost 10 years now. U.S. warplanes were stationed at up to six former Iraqi air bases, becoming the principal enforcer of the occupation. U.S. troops were thinned out. By 2020, this job was done so skillfully that the U.S. presence in Iraq became almost invisible. Hold on, I said almost. Iraq was occupied by Western forces, but it looked like an independent nation with the U.S. installed president and executive branch. Kurdish areas in the north became virtual U.S.-run mini-states. The demented Daesh movement was totally stamped out by Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. As a thank you, the Iranian military supremo in Iraq, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps al-Quds forces, was ordered murdered by President Trump. Deputy head of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, arose a martyr that day alongside his dear friend and comrade, Martyr Hajj Qasem Soleimani. This great mistake turned the golden victory in Iraq promised by the American neocons into ashes, leaving Washington stuck deep in an ungovernable nation, yet still capable of defeating Daesh and then targeting its real enemy, the U.S. occupation forces scattered in Iraq. Faced by the threat of more resistance guerrilla warfare, Joe Biden's administration announced it would pull all remaining U.S. combat troops from Iraq, but leaving 2,500 behind for training and embassy security. Training is a bad joke. Iraq has been almost in constant war since 1980. Iraqis need loyalty, pride, and patriotism to be effective fighters. How did I know? Here's a hint. Take a look at how Hashd al-Shaabi operates and you'll realize what the Iraqi army is missing. Who needs training from the armed forces that got whipped in Vietnam and now in Afghanistan? Iraq needs a real national government rather than foreign agents in Baghdad. Which is basically why, my friends, the U.S. will not withdraw from Iraq. It might change the name of its combat forces, but an occupation will always be an occupation, with resistance being its only form of elimination. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq approaches by the end of 2021, Iraqis remain skeptical about whether the withdrawal is real or just on paper. In July, the United States and Iraq held a strategic dialogue session during which the two countries agreed on withdrawing all U.S. combat troops from Iraq by December 31st of this year. Now, Tahsin al-Khafaji, spokesman of the Iraqi Joint Operations Command, had announced last month that most of the combat forces left Iraq and only advisors and those working in the field of intelligence, investigation, and training remained, reiterating that they will leave within 15 days. However, Iraqis fear that there might be no real withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, neither now after the 15 days have actually passed, nor in the upcoming new year. Rather, as many of the observers believe, there will be only a change in the name of these forces. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Al-Basra in Iraq is Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Madhoush. It's a pleasure having you on our show. Now, it seems that the question of the century is, will the U.S. really pull out of its of Iraq with its occupation forces by the end of this year, or will it just hang in there and stay? They might chill. They have nothing to lose.
Ya Allah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Thank you for hosting me on your show. Of course, as it's well known, especially to those who deal with American approach and behavior, they know that the Americans have great ambitions and intentions announced openly concerning their interests here in Iraq and the region. All this eruption and all this fallout and fragmentation and this great weakness and instability in the region is because none other than the U.S. America has reneged on covenants it had ratified with its own hands. Anyone with just little insight knows very well that if America comes out a door, it re-enters through a wider one and changes colors like a chameleon using painful methods. Undoubtedly, the U.S. cannot leave this region as it views it as spoils of war par excellence.
Well, Ms. Ali, according to the agreement between Baghdad and Washington, the American forces will keep personnel for, and I quote here, consulting, training, equipment, or equipping, and exchanging intelligence information, I don't know with whom, but that's what they're saying. Now, who's to say that the U.S. won't keep all of its forces, but simply just change their name on paper, or maybe move the combat forces to Syria at a close range from Iraq at all times?
I totally agree with you. It was agreed and approved by Iraqi law and voted on by the Iraqi parliament that no foreign military presence will be allowed in Iraq after December 31, 2021, which is the last legal day for the U.S. presence inside Iraq. However, we know there's a lot of maneuvering and a lot of getting around this decision. In fact, I tell you that there are those inside Iraq who do not want America to leave, unfortunately. The order of the occupation forces to remain is not dependent on America as much as it's dependent on the interests of the certain Iraqi employers of foreign forces. It's humiliating, to be honest with you, how hard they fight to make sure the Americans remain here, crouching on the chest of the Iraqis and the region. There are many measures that America has put in place regarding the neighboring periphery, such as the border with Al-Bukamal and the border with the western region of Iraq. There is also the U.S. Embassy, which contains the largest military base and which America uses advanced defense equipment to protect, as if it wants to stay forever. We agree with you that there is a maneuver that America has prepared for. We are sure that the U.S. forces' exit will only happen on paper, but the truth remains, and they cannot change it.
Ms. Ali, Iraqi political groups have called the formation of an alliance to expel American troops from the Arab country, from Iraq, when their mandate finishes by the end of this year, stating that Washington's attempts to prolong the presence of its occupation forces must never be taken into consideration. Do you think that is actually a viable option in case Washington proves to be actually dodging the withdrawal date? Do you think that fighting it out is the option?
It's well known that the Iraqi resistance factions, represented today by the popular mobilization forces, have become deterrent forces against the American entity and the usurping Israeli entity. This resistance has formed an equation of balance of forces. It's the resistance alliance that hurt the Americans and has become a striking tool for restoring rights and limiting the role of the Americans in the region. Today, the Iraqi government and its institutions and the Iraqi regular army undoubtedly have many U.S.-imposed restrictions and many strict measures as they cannot proceed with the process of extracting the Iraqi right. We have harnessed a great experience in fighting the American forces after the U.S. invasion. The U.S. occupation has suffered many hard blows by the Iraqi resistance factions. Undoubtedly, America is determined and waiting for the moment when law, Sharia, custom and humanity justify for us to expel the occupier from our country, especially against an occupation that breaks all laws. So basically, after December 31, Iraq turns into an occupied country, and all occupied countries have the full right to defend their lands and stand in the face of the invaders. May God give more strength to the Iraqi resistance factions. It always does what it vows to do. The U.S. occupation is always on high alert because of the severity of the resistance valor. The awareness of its leaders and its bases that have experienced war for years now, fighting and eliminating Daesh is an example.
Well, Ms. Ali, we know by heart by now how the U.S. operates when it desires to change reality on the ground, especially in Iraq. We might witness a sharp escalation of chaos, of tensions within the coming weeks as part of efforts to drive U.S. Forces to stay further inside of the country under the pretext of maintaining security inside of Iraq. How do you think the Iraqi resistance forces will react to such a possible scenario?
It is no secret for everyone who follows the American dirty politics that it plays bad roles in its cultural war, its media war, its software, its policy of containment, its policy of interfering in internal affairs and imposing its influence by different means and under many pretexts. Today, many countries fall for American lies, such as Saudi Arabia and others, who are deluded into the existence of the illusion of an enemy represented by the Islamic Republic of Iran, in order to create an excuse to sell weapons and maintain their forces and interests in West Asia. Therefore, America will create many crises inside Iraq, but the conscious, the knowledgeable, the people of politics, and those who are aware are following and monitoring this phenomenon. Today, we see that the signs of Americans' embrace of some factions and its sponsorship of some parties have begun to create an unstable and abnormal situation that will place Iraq on a hot plate. Signs of these movements started from the American support for some factions and forces in order to provoke instability that will lead all Iraqi blocs to turn to other external forces to take care of Iraq and get it out of this predicament. Today, the political tensions is evident under the auspices of America and its great intervention by changing the rules of the game. But the resistance forces and factions are conscious and want to miss the U.S. opportunity to invade. Today in Iraq, both wisdom and strength are present to confront America using its own tools.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator, for joining us from Al-Basra, Iraq. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. And please now stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what options does the Iraqi resistance have to try and push the occupation out of Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Prior to Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's visit to the United States, the New York Times described the new agreement to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq as nothing but a diplomatic play, while Sabrin News, channel affiliated with the Popular Mobilization Forces, criticized the agreement, saying that no American soldier will be withdrawn, their role will only be changed on paper. Why is this agreement seen as a theatrical show? Well, a number of pro-U.S. Iraqi leaders do not want to see the United States completely withdrawing from Iraq. These officials propagate that the U.S. actually supports a stable and friendly Iraq, while asserting every chance they get that a long-term U.S. presence, although maintains American influence in Iraq, however, it will help them mitigate Iranian, Russian, and other forms of what the U.S. refers to as malign influence. Funny how other states that enjoy normal diplomatic non-military ties with Iraq are viewed as malign by the U.S., while its own forces of occupation is praised as friendship. On second thought, no, it's not funny, it's actually sick. Will the U.S. ever leave Iraq? More in this following report.
Ever since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, it was required of the U.S. occupation to exploit Iraq within a strategy that affects the entire region. However, in recent months, the so-called strategic dialogue between Baghdad and Washington, which set a time frame for the withdrawal of American forces and whose sessions took place under the threats and strikes of the Iraqi resistance led by factions of the Hashd al-Shaabi, gave many indications of how Iraq has turned from an imminent American threat against the axis of resistance in the early post-invasion stages to a threat against the presence of American occupation forces as part of this same axis. And if Iraq's positioning in the U.S. strategy was mainly related to striking the centers of power supporting the resistance movements between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, that is Syria and Iran, while making Iraq the center of an active American presence in the region, then the reality that American policy has reached does not only indicate a failure in that particular goal, but rather exceeds it to with a failure within Iraq itself. It was not required to isolate Iraq during the invasion stage from the ongoing state of conflict with the Israeli occupation entity, because it was already outside that conflict. Rather, what was required of Iraq was to be used to isolate and neutralize Syria and Iran, and then attack later on the resistance factions. However, in the years following the invasion, Washington's calculations collided with the transformations witnessed in the Iraqi arena. Iraq itself turned into a popular military and security offshoot for different resistance factions in West Asia, and indeed has become among its deterrent force. In recent months, Iraqi resistance factions affiliated with the popular mobilization Hashd al-Shaabi announced that they had entered the deterrence equation regarding al-Quds, which was announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, considering that violating al-Quds equals a regional war. This particular part expresses the transformation inside Iraq, which the United States has always been trying to prevent. This was clearly demonstrated in the report of the Israeli National Security Institute at the end of last year, considering that the Zionist front in any upcoming war will be attacked with thousands of missiles, including dozens of precision missiles and armed drones from several arenas in parallel, from Lebanon, Syria, Western Iraq, and probably Gaza as well. The American military and political presence in Iraq is now threatened by the Hashd al-Shaabi forces, and things could spiral towards a military escalation if the United States tries to circumvent the promises of its withdrawal at a time when the latter seems unable to enter into an open war. This development was never by chance. Washington was seeking to place Iraq on the map of confronting Syria and Iran, but the resistance axis was aware of the danger of the American scheme leading the axis to embrace Iraqi resistance forces in the post-occupation stage. This kept the American tactic trapped inside the Iraqi arena and transferred it from a strategy of dismantling Syria and Iran outside Iraq to a practical path of dismantling its own military occupation bases inside of it, due to the threats of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Stockholm is Mr. Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Firas. Now, the top U.S. commander of the Middle East, his name is General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, he said last week that the United States will keep the current 2,500 troops inside of Iraq for what he said is the foreseeable future. So they're not leaving after all. So why all this propaganda of them leaving when they're not?
Well, I think it's business as usual for the Americans. They're trying to confuse the Iraqi people by conveying different type of information in this regard. Sometimes they say they're going to leave. Sometimes they say we have to make a deal first. And mostly they say we're not going to leave. We're changing the status, the title of the troops in Iraq from combating troops to advisors. But regardless of what they call them, they're only playing with words and counting on time. But no one in Iraq is interested, and especially not the resistance, to play any word feud games with them. They're going to stay. What I think is that the Americans don't have the intention to leave Iraq. They have to be forced out of Iraq, because they have invested a lot of money in Iraq, and they've invested and built the biggest embassy in the world in Baghdad, second to the one that's going to come up in Beirut. And they have a military camp in the embassy, the Union 3 camp. So there's a reason for them to resist being forced out from Iraq. But I think this method that they're using by wasting time, counting on time, and trying to confuse people won't work, because they think that people will forget the occupation and go on. But it won't work, because the Iraqi people, especially after the assassination in January last year, have changed, and the tide has changed against the United States of America.
Well, Firas, basically, despite the so-called shift by U.S. forces to a non-combat role in Iraq, they said clearly that they will still provide air support and other military aid for Iraq's fight against Daesh terrorist groups. Now, hold on a second there, because the entire globe already knows who bred, funded, and trained Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And For the love of God, I mean, America killed the two most prominent commanders in West Asia who actually fought and eliminated Daesh, and I'm talking about Martyr Soleimani and Martyr Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. How come the Iraqi population is just okay with this? They continue with their lives when they are being played by the United States of America.
I don't think generally people in Iraq are okay with this. The Iraqi people has a lot of grievances, of course, and the Americans are making them bigger to just to adjust the time so they can still go on and be have a presence in Iraq. But the title that they're giving to their forces, advisors, that's only a title. The Americans has already acted in Iraq since they came back in 2014 as landlords, and they will continue to do so as long as they are in Iraq. They have not heeded to the agreement they had with the Iraqi government since 2014, and they've acted by they've controlled the Iraqi airspace totally, and they dealt with the Iraqi resistance forces and Hashd al-Shaabi, which is basically part of the Defense Department in Iraq, as terrorists sometimes. And you have the unexpected visit of Trump to Ayn al-Assad, which the Iraqi government didn't know of, and actually in the assassination of the commander of the leaders of the victory leaders, as you mentioned, the Americans used more drones in Iraqi airspace in that operation than what they are allowed to in their deal with the Iraqi government. So no Iraqi accept their presence in Iraq if they don't have any personal benefit. But I would say most Iraqis despise the Americans because they remember that most of their problems from the ascending of the Ba'ath Party was because of U.S. interference in Iraq. They have not forgotten that the United States of America imposed two wars on Iraq. They forced the Iraqi government in eight years war with Iran, and they put sanctions on the Iraqi people that killed more than and half a million Iraqi children. The Secretary of State in the United States at that time, Albright, said that this is a price worth to pay, and the Iraqis remember this. And actually, it was the Iraqi people's representatives in the parliament who voted to expel the U.S. troops. So the political situation in Iraq is a mess sometimes, but this vote in the parliament is historic because it shows how big the disapprovement of the U.S. forces in Iraq are.
So basically, the U.S. will try to delay its withdrawal, just as you said, to suggest that it actually has the upper hand in where it goes with its troops, instead of actually being compelled to be kicked out of Iraq and withdraw. But the Iraqi resistance seemingly has a very different plan for the U.S. occupation forces. How do you see the upcoming year in Iraq, knowing that the U.S. has never stood by its declarations and agreements when it comes to any area that it occupies?
The Iraqi resistance have been very clear about the issue. They have given the Americans a deadline, but until the 31st of December this year, New Year's Eve, to leave. And if they don't leave, they will be counted as occupation forces and dealt by that. But remember again that the resistance forces have not been idle since the assassination and the vote in parliament last year. They have notified the Americans from now and then about their presence and which type of resistance they will be forced with if they stay in Iraq. They have attacked a lot of logistical support for the U.S. forces in Iraq. It could sound like small acts, but we have to remember that targeted items are not cheap. It's state-of-art military equipment that costs $100 billion maybe. So the Americans have faced the pain, and it's obvious because the Iraqi government, which Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi leads now, has ordered Iraqi soldiers to go out and patrol those streets that the U.S. logistical support passed by to ensure their safety. But it hasn't been successful. It has been in vain. So the resistance is clever, and they have managed to continue their attacks. One of the resistance forces, Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada, actually opened the door for volunteers to fight the Americans if they stay after New Year's Eve. And just a couple of days, three or four days after they opened the window for that, they have to close it because they got more than 50,000 volunteers who are ready to fight the Americans if they're going to stay in Iraq.
So basically, Iraq is looking at a very tense upcoming new year in the event the Americans remain, but we have faith that the Iraqi resistance has the upper hand in Iraq. And thank you very much, Mr. Firas Ali, for joining us to talk about this issue from Stockholm as a political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. Home is the best place for asceticism. If you want to live like a spiritual wayfarer, the best place is home. Of course, there are certain types of ascetic deeds which need spiritual trainer. However, I believe that the best place to grow spiritually is inside the house and with the family. Once, a person went to Allama Tabatabai and asked him for spiritual guidelines on spiritual development. Upon hearing this request, Allama Tabatabai asked him, "Are you married or single? What has it to do with spiritual growth?" The man asked. Allama answered, "Some deeds which are considered spiritual for a single person will be harmful for a married one. This means that married people and single ones might have different spiritual experiences which are not necessarily the same. For instance, going to the mosque up until midnight and help to take care of the affairs of the mosque will be great for a single person, but might be harmful for a married person who must be inside the house and take care of the affairs of the family. Worshipping Allah is not always being inside a mosque or religious gatherings. It can be manifested in doing the house chores and helping the family too." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. We are presently discussing the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and offers his strategy in leadership and his methodology of leadership. And there he of course mentions some things in a very straightforward way because, you know, as a leader, he had to make it clear about the goals and about the strategy that he has to follow. And this was something very important. And as we mentioned, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was offering a legislation, a method of social governance, a political, you know, theory or a political method of governance, that political system was definitely a true system. Why was it true? Because he was aware of the society. He had true knowledge of the society. He had knowledge and awareness of the essence of the society, of the laws, the natural laws, the divine, overruling decrees that govern the society, and the natural, you know, laws that exist within a society. And because of this awareness, he had that ability and that suitability to be able to offer a powerful political system.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
And we said previously, of course, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about one of those laws, and that law is that if a person were to contemplate, if a society were to contemplate on the past regarding the progress and the deterioration of the societies and the reasons behind that, then definitely that society, those people will be protected from making wrong decisions in the community. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and gives one example of an analysis, offers an example of an analysis in recent history which was applicable to them at that time. He says a very surprising and perturbing thing. He says, أَلَا إِنَّ بَنِيَّتَكُمْ قَدْ عَادَتْ كَهَيْئَتِهَا يَوْمَ بَعَثَ اللَّهُ نَبِيَّكُمْ. He says, O people, your situation today is the same as your situation when the messenger of God came to you. You are facing the same problem. Your problem has returned. That same problem that your fathers had, that same malady that your fathers had, has come back to you today. O sick people, O humanity that is ill and sick, you have the same sickness once again, just like the one you had when the Prophet came to you. That means the sickness has returned, the illness has come back, the virus has come back. And Ali alayhi salam was a doctor. He knew that this sickness has returned. And that is what he was telling the people. And he knew that he could cure it. And he wanted to cure it. But now, what was this sickness? Again, see, Imam Ali alayhi salam, because of his awareness of the social laws, he knows that this sickness has come back. And the reason behind this sickness is people have tranquilized themselves. And they do not want to contemplate and analyze the recent history and see the application of those difficulties and problems and the reasons why those problems came in their life today. So he knew that the sickness has come back, and this is something that we are going to analyze shortly.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, some would say, what is this sickness? Unfortunately, some falsely claim that this thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, this baliya, this difficulty, this problem that has come back, is just, you know, differences in opinion, conflict and schism that exists between people. That's what they say. They say that difficulty and that problem that you're facing, that sickness that the people are facing today, and it is the same sickness that the Muslims had at the time of the Prophet, was the illness, was the sickness, was the problem of conflict and difference and dissimilarity and fighting. That is the problem that they are saying. But is this actually what Imam Ali was to say? Was the sickness of the people just a few differences or some conflict that existed between them? Was this the problem at that time? If we ask the question carefully, we'll see no, this was not the problem. Because the true Muslims were all united. They were not disunited, or they didn't have any difference. There was no conflict between them. They all came together. Thousands and thousands of them came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they all united under his leadership. Well, some would say that Sa'd bin Abi Waqas, Talha and Zubair, they kind of separated themselves. We would say that this was not a difference. This was not a difference or a very considerable, serious difference, because it was just a very, very trivial issue which led them to be separate. We can't say that this was a conflict within the nation. The whole nation was in conflict and indifference. We cannot say that. And therefore, those people who claim that actually the problem that Imam Ali alayhi salam is referring to here is conflict, differences, dissimilarities and disunity, this doesn't seem to be a correct view. But inshallah, we will discuss about what is actually what Imam Ali alayhi salam meant here when he said that your difficulty and your problem and your sickness has returned, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
South Koreans enjoy a wildlife refuge near the Korean Demilitarized Zone. New tours opened in November from the DMZ Crane Peace Town. Frank Smith has more in this report.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.